Welcome. We begin chapter 23 in the Yoga of Integral Knowledge now. The conditions of attainment to the gnosis. The chapter was originally titled The Conditions of Gnosis when it appeared on 15 October 1917. And it is always well to note that this is among that group of essays that Sri Aurobindo partially and sometimes substantially revised. Those revisions probably occurred in 1932, but they were unpublished. All of this work that he did in the Yoga of Integral Knowledge did not see print until 1955, 4 or 5 years after he left his body. So until then, the one section that he had completed in his review of the synthesis of yoga was the Yoga of Divine Works. And of course, that is ample. We can read that again and again and glean lessons and insights every time we open the book, turn a page. But this Yoga of Integral Knowledge was unreachable to his many readers inside the ashram and outside until 1955, when we have it in front of us. Now, other revisions that he made did not see publication until this very book that you're looking at here, if you're reading in the collected works of Sri Aurobindo. The new set, let us call it. Well, we'll begin. The conditions of attainment to the gnosis. Knowledge is the first principle of the vijnana, but knowledge is not its only power. The truth consciousness, like every other plane, founds itself upon that particular principle which is naturally the key of all its motions. But it is not limited by it. It contains all the other powers of existence. So we'll pause for a moment and note that in this very first sentence, Sri Aurobindo has already made a revision. And then has proceeded to rewrite the rest of the first paragraph. So our context here in following Sri Aurobindo's cosmology is that the unnameable reality, which the Rig Veda sometimes called tat, that. If it wishes to present itself positively, asserts itself as sat-chit-ananda, an existence conscious of itself and whose experience of itself is endless delight. There is no wall to being, there is no wall to consciousness, there is no wall to the experience of delight. Chit, that power of consciousness, is also a power of complete force. What is seen in the consciousness is effectuated necessarily. And it demonstrates this when it establishes as an act of its own innate, unexpressed will, but suggested, hinted, as the Vijnana, this vast consciousness which distributes the truths of Satchitananda, takes its infinity and manifests it endlessly in a tremendous harmony in which the oneness of that, of this consciousness seeing itself, is not abrogated. So he notes something that is essential to understand in the life divine, essential to understand in how the cosmos works, that all the principles of existence, and remember that there is an omnipresent reality, all persist and exist in every plane, in every relationship that occurs, in which Purusha and Prakriti dance, whether it's in Vijnana, or mind, or life, or matter, whatever the mode of manifestation, this dance between the soul and nature embraces all possibilities. So it isn't that supramental is not here. The supramental is an omnipresent reality. Just as the life power exists in mind, supermind exists in matter, life and mind. All are co-penetrating, but it is not manifest, has it? So there's the whole question of it. So this relationship that knowledge has as being key to the supramental does not divest it of other powers. All powers, all possibilities are there endlessly. Simply knowledge, gnosis, stands out in the front. We'll touch upon gnosis a little later. So he continues, only the character and working of these other powers is modified and molded into conformity with its own original and dominant law. Intelligence, life, body, will, consciousness, bliss are all luminous, awake, instinct with divine knowledge. This is indeed the process of Purusha Prakriti everywhere. It is the key movement of all the hierarchy and graded harmonies of manifested existence. In the mental being, mind sense or intelligence is the original and dominant principle. The mental being in the mind world, where he is native, is in his central and determining nature, intelligence. He is a center of intelligence, a massed movement of intelligence, a receptive and radiating action of intelligence. He has the intelligent sense of his own existence, the intelligent sense of other existence than his own, the intelligent sense of his own nature and activities, and the activities of others, the intelligent sense of the nature of things and persons and their relations with himself and each other. That makes up his experience of existence. He has no other knowledge of existence, no knowledge of life and matter, except as they make themselves sensible to him and capable of being seized by his mental intelligence. What he does not sense and conceive is to him practically non-existent, or at least alien to his world and his nature. So you see, the play of the mind is an intermediary. Knowledge is not by identity there. It is by reference through another entity to itself. something has to be capable of being seized by his mental intelligence. There is an other. Man is, in his principle, a mental being, but not one living in a mind world, but in a dominantly physical existence. His is a mind cased in matter and conditioned by matter. Therefore, he has to start with the action of the physical senses, which are all channels of material contact. So let's remember how mind is defined in the Sankhyan system, because Sri Aurobindo is alluding to it in this paragraph. All the senses, the gross elements that they contact, the subtle elements that they contact, are pieces of data, phenomena occurring in the world, and manas, the receiving mind, reaches out, looks and sees, and gathers them together, and composites them into a whole. So, manas is dependent in its normal action upon the senses. So let's see here how the term sense plays in this paragraph. Therefore, he has to start with the action of the physical senses, which are all channels of material contact. He does not start with the mind sense. So the action of this intelligence, of this mental being, is acquiring. Is it possible for manas to know directly and without reliance upon the senses? Yes, but that's not the question here. Ordinarily, it reaches through these intermediaries to gather knowledge and experience of the world. But even so, he does not and cannot make free use of anything conveyed by these physical organs until and unless they are taken hold of by the mind sense, manas, and turned into stuff and value of his intelligent being. What is in the lower subhuman, submental world, a pranic, a nervous, a dynamic action and reaction that proceeds very well without any need of translation into mind terms or government by mind, has in him to be raised and offered to some kind of intelligence. In order to be characteristically human, it has to become first a sense of force, sense of desire, sense of will, sense of intelligent will action, or mentally conscious sense of force action. His lower delight of being translates itself into a sense of mental or mentalized vital or physical pleasure and its perversion, pain, or into a mental or mentalized feeling sensation of liking and disliking, or into an intelligence of delight and failure of delight, all phenomena of the intelligent mind sense. So too, that which is above him and that which is around him and in which he lives, God, the universal being, the cosmic forces, are non-existent and unreal to him until his mind awakes to them and gets not yet their true truth, but some idea, observation, inference, imagination of things supersensuous, some mental sense of the infinite, some intelligent interpreting consciousness of the forces of the super-self above and around him. And so, the weakness of the mind. It only knows by derivation. It knows by collection. It doesn't know by penetration and by union. All changes when we pass from mind to gnosis. For there, a direct inherent knowledge is the central principle. The Gnostic, vijnanamaya, being is in its character a truth consciousness. Vijnanamaya means filled with this distributing power of conscious knowledge. The Gnostic Vijnanamaya being is in its character a truth consciousness, a center and a center and circumference of the truth vision of things, a massed movement or subtle body of gnosis. So if you can remember in the last chapter, Sri Aurobindo described Chidgana, where consciousness is gathered together and compressed, held tight. This is tapas. This is the force of consciousness working on itself, on its own being, to produce something. A massed movement or subtle body. If you can imagine that knowledge takes a form, informs itself into a body, into a rupa, this is vijnana. Its action is a self-fulfilling and radiating action of the truth power of things according to the inner law of their deepest, truest self and nature. So, if it knows itself utterly, and consciousness and will, knowledge and will, are one movement in the supramental consciousness of vijnana, of the gnosis, then it is necessarily self-fulfilling. It is swayambhu. It exists in its own being. Without any other to compete against it, naturally it fulfills its will. Its will is impartite. And so then its truth radiates out. See it as a sun. See all the rays coming out of the sun. Each ray is a truth manifesting something unique. All of it linked to the common reality that is its source and self. This truth of things at which we must arrive before we can enter into the gnosis, for in that all exists and from that all originates on the Gnostic plane, is first of all a truth of unity, of oneness, but of unity originating diversity, unity in multiplicity, and still unity always. An indefeasible oneness. Don't you love that word? It means not to be defeated. It means not to be made void, from the old French. State of gnosis, the condition of vijnanamaya being, is impossible without an ample and close self-identification of ourselves with all existence and with all existences, a universal pervasiveness, a universal comprehension or containing a certain all-in-allness. So, this idea of gnosis from the Greek, you know, it was a great school of philosophy and mystical knowledge, which probably reached its peak in the second century of the Common Era and had left a powerful imprint on Christianity. And while they called themselves Gnostics, because they were looking for secret knowledge, they had something of this idea that is common to Plotinus, common even to Sri Aurobindo's philosophy, in that there is an original reality which moves out into self-expression and through a series of planar developments, which they would call in the Gnostic schools emanations, one power after another, laying down an element of existence all the way until you reach matter, and a darkening along the way, so that what was a spiritual truth above is no longer a spiritual truth when you arrive at the material world. And so the natural good of things disappears, and one has to struggle in darkness and evil. And what we must do is lift ourselves up to attain again, through spiritual knowledge, an identity with that. Well, there's much more to it. But this idea of light and dark in the Gnostics gets supplanted in the history of Christianity and theistic religion by Manichaeanism, which comes from ancient Persia, you know, where there is an absolute war between light and dark. Well, we can see in Sri Aurobindo, all is essentially housed in light. So there is no such thing as an absolute war. And as big as these great asuras might be, they may be immense, but they are not infinite. And the supramental, and the one which expresses the supramental, is infinite. The Gnostic Purusha, he writes, has normally the consciousness of itself as infinite. Normally, too, the consciousness of containing the world in itself and exceeding it. It is not like the divided mental being, normally bound to a consciousness that feels itself contained in the world and a part of it. So, look at this. Here it is, infinite, stationed in the world, perfectly aware of its own unique being, but also exceeding it, transcending it, going beyond. So all the three terms of primary existence, of the first reality, transcendence, universality, and individuality, all present here in this Gnostic person, feels itself contained in the world and a part of it. It follows that a deliverance from the limiting and imprisoning ego is the first elementary step towards the being of the gnosis. For as long as we live in the ego, it is idle to hope for this higher reality, this vast self-consciousness, this true self-knowledge. The least reversion to ego thought, ego action, ego will brings back the consciousness tumbling out of such Gnostic truth as it has attained into the falsehoods of the divided mind nature. Sri Aurobindo, again, is writing here from deep psychology. These are not philosophic manifestations of the thinker and the seer here. These are the reflections of an active yogic experience. Sri Aurobindo has himself gone through all of this and found where the ego pinches, where it makes it impossible to progress, and so notes it. A secure universality of being is the very basis of this luminous higher consciousness. Abandoning all rigid separateness, but getting instead a certain transcendent overlook or independence, we have to feel ourselves one with all things and beings, to identify ourselves with them, to become aware of them as ourselves, to feel their being as our own, to admit their consciousness as part of ours, to contact their energy as intimate to our energy, to learn how to be oneself with all. That oneness is not indeed all that is needed, but it is a first condition, and without it, there is no gnosis. This universality is impossible to achieve in its completeness so long as we continue to feel ourselves as we now feel, a consciousness lodged in an individual mind, life, and body. There has to be a certain elevation of the Purusha out of the physical and even out of the mental into the Vijnanamaya body. No longer can the brain, nor its corresponding mental lotus, remain the center of our thinking. No longer the heart, nor its corresponding lotus, the originating center of our emotional and sensational being. So those would be the Ajna and the Anahata chakras. The conscious center of our being, our thought, our will and action, even the original force of our sensations and emotions, rise out of the body and mind and take a free station above them. So this is establishing oneself in the liberated regions above, through that thousand-petaled lotus, which is a miniature collection of what is the supramental consciousness. One can reach that Sahasrara and yet its infinity is not the supramental. But it conduces us to rise beyond farther and reach to the rim of the supramental. No longer have we the sensation of living in the body, but are above it as its Lord, possessor, or Ishwara, and at the same time encompass it with a wider consciousness than that of the imprisoned physical sense. So this puts it spatially. There is height, there is breadth. Now we come to realize, with the very living force of reality, normal and continuous, what the sages meant when they spoke of the soul carrying the body, or when they said that the soul is not in the body, but the body in the soul. It is from above the body and not from the brain that we shall ideate and will. The brain action will become only a response and movement of the physical machinery to the shock of the thought force and will force from above. All will be originated from above. From above, all that corresponds in gnosis to our present mental activity takes place. So, this is a set of observations which encompass centuries of yogic practice, and which in Sri Aurobindo began in 1908 with his first realization. Even then, before he knew there were planes of awareness above, he followed the direction and simply opened himself as he stood ready to make a speech and let the words flow into him from above. He knew not their source. He would discover that in subsequent months and years and make perfect his reception of it as he rose in consciousness to meet it. There's a footnote. Many, if not all, of these conditions of the Gnostic change can and indeed have to be attained long before we reach the Gnosis, but imperfectly at first, as if by a reflection. Ah, Purusha, Prakriti, Buddhi, seeing the reality of Purusha reflected in the natural instrument. Let's start again. Many, if not all, of these conditions of the Gnostic change can and indeed have to be attained long before we reach the gnosis in higher mind itself, and more completely in what we may call an overmind consciousness between mentality and gnosis. So Sri Aurobindo here in 1932 has been moving, fixed in this realm for at least half a decade, after realizing in the body the power of the overmind. So this description that these changes can occur before getting to the height of gnosis makes sense, because we see the same insights in many of the Upanishads with the great seers, the leaders of the age, have registered these same truths. But for them, they're primarily psychological. Their inner realizations, which seem not to have had impact on the dynamic life. Sri Aurobindo has been careful with every advance to implant the realization, the growth of consciousness in all the elements of the nature, and then finally into the sinews of the body. But this center and this action are free, not bound, not dependent on the physical machine, not clamped to a narrow ego sense. It is not involved in body. It is not shut up in a separated individuality, feeling out for clumsy contacts with the world outside, or groping inward for its own deeper spirit. For in this great transformation, we begin to have a consciousness not shut up in a generating box, but diffused freely and extending self-existently everywhere. There is, or may be, a center, but it is a convenience for individual action, not rigid, not constitutive or separative. The very nature of our conscious activities is henceforth universal. One with those of the universal being, it proceeds from universality to a supple and variable individualization. It has become the awareness of an infinite being who acts always universally, though with emphasis on an individual formation of its energies. But this emphasis is differential rather than separative, and this formation is no longer what we now understand by individuality. There is no longer a petty, limited, constructed person shut up in the formula of his own mechanism. This state of consciousness is so abnormal to our present mode of being that to the rational man who does not possess it, it may seem impossible or even a state of alienation, but once possessed, it vindicates itself even to the mental intelligence by its greater calm, freedom, light, power, effectivity of will, verifiable truth of ideation and feeling. For this condition begins already on the higher levels of liberated mind, and can therefore be partly sensed and understood by mind intelligence. But it rises to perfect self-possession only when it leaves behind the mental levels, only in the supramental gnosis. Hmm. In this state of consciousness, the infinite becomes to us the primal, the actual reality, the one thing immediately and sensibly true. It becomes impossible for us to think of or realize the finite apart from our fundamental sense of the infinite, in which alone the infinite, in which alone the finite can live, can form itself, can have any reality or duration. So long as this finite mind and body are to our consciousness the first fact of our existence and the foundation of all our thinking, feeling, and willing, and so long as things finite are the normal reality from which we can rise occasionally or even frequently to an idea and sense of the infinite, we are still very far away from the gnosis. In the plane of the gnosis, the infinite is at once our normal consciousness of being, its first fact, our sensible substance. It is very concretely to us there, the foundation from which everything finite forms itself. And its boundless, incalculable forces are the origination of all our thought, will, and delight. But this infinite is not only an infinite of pervasion or of extension in which everything forms and happens. Behind that immeasurable extension, the Gnostic consciousness is always aware of a spaceless inner infinite. It is through this double infinite that we shall arrive at the essential being of Satchit Ananda, the highest self of our own being and the totality of our cosmic existence. There is open to us an illimitable existence which we feel as if it were an infinity above us, to which we attempt to rise, and an infinity around us, into which we strive to dissolve our separate existence. Afterwards, we widen into it and rise into it. We break out of the ego into its largeness and are there forever. If this liberation is achieved, its power can take, if so we will, increasing possession of our lower being. Increasing possession of our lower being also, until even our lowest and perversest activities are refashioned into the truth of the Vijnana. So we set that there as our bookmark, and we'll continue and complete the chapter next time. I thought we'd read from Savitri. This is in Book 7, the Book of Yoga, Canto 2, the Parable of the Search for the Soul. And this begins on page 484. But this is only matter's first self-view, a scale and series in the ignorance. This is not all we are or all our world. Our greater self of knowledge waits for us, a supreme light in the truth-conscious vast. It sees from summits beyond thinking mind. It moves in a splendid air, transcending life. It shall descend and make earth's life divine. truth made the world, not a blind nature force. For here are not our large diviner heights. Our summits in the superconscience blaze are glorious with the very face of God. There is our aspect of eternity. There is the figure of the God we are, his youth, unaging look on deathless things, his young, unaging look on deathless things, his joy in our escape from death and time, his immortality and light and bliss. Our larger being sits behind cryptic walls. There are greatnesses hidden in our unseen parts that wait their hour to step into life's front. We feel an aid from deep indwelling gods. One speaks within. Light comes to us from above. Our soul from its mysterious chamber acts, its influence pressing on our heart and mind, pushes them to exceed their mortal selves. It seeks for good and beauty and for God. We see beyond self's walls our limitless self. We gaze through our world's glass at half-seen vasts. We hunt for the truth behind apparent things. Our inner mind dwells in a larger light. Its brightness looks at us through hidden doors. Our members luminous grow, and wisdom's face appears in the doorway of the mystic ward. When she enters into our house of outward sense, then we look up and see above her sun, a mighty life self with its inner powers, supports the dwarfish modicum we call life. It can graft upon our crawl two puissant wings. Our body's subtle self is throned within in its viewless palace of veridical dreams that are bright shadows of the thoughts of God. In the prone, obscure beginnings of the race, the human grew in the bowed, ape-like man. He stood erect, a godlike form and force, and a soul's thoughts looked out from earth-born eyes. Man stood erect, he wore the thinker's brow. He looked at heaven and saw his comrade stars. A vision came of beauty and greater birth, slowly emerging from the heart's chapel of light and moved in a white, lucent air of dreams. He saw his being's unrealized vastnesses. He aspired and housed the nascent demigod. Out of the dim recesses of the self, the occult seeker into the open came. He heard the far and touched the intangible. He gazed into the future and the unseen. He used the powers earth instruments cannot use, a pastime made of the impossible. He caught up fragments of the omniscient's thought. He scattered formulas of omnipotence. Thus man, in his little house made of earth's dust, grew towards an unseen heaven of thought and dream, looking into the vast vistas of his mind on a small globe dotting infinity. As with the rest of the chapter, we'll read the rest of that passage next Sunday. Let's all gather for that. And since we're speaking so richly of oneness and all that it betokens, I do want to remind you that there is a book called The One Book. Ask me how to get it. I'll give you the key. Still in the redolence and the radiance of the 24th of April, where they launched the great work in which we have a role, I salute you. Namaste. Jai Ma.